How many of you know that God blessed Abraham with riches? Blessed him with silver and gold. How many of you like silver and gold? Those of you that don't, you're in the wrong church.
The apostles were businessmen. They were rich men, had plenty of money. I'm going to show you that Jesus was a wealthy man, had plenty of money. And see, all of that completely foreign to us from a tradition.
There will be 50 people give $1,000 and do it right now or I am finished. Try me.
And if you'll call during this telecast for you that support our ministry in any way, just call the number on your screen. We'll rush this out to you. Many of you during this time of year need to anoint your billboard with this oil for a financial blessing.
Yes, come out of him, you foul devils, in the name of Jesus. Get ready. This is the power of God. Come out of us. This is the power of God. 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 Come out.
But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who mistreat you.
Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 160, Book of Eli, A Weapon for the Apocalypse.
Welcome back, Sci-Fi Sickies, to Apocalypse August 2, the sequel, or the aftermath. And this was, I gotta say, this month was really born out of the idea that we're gonna be covering this month is what I envisioned we'd be doing last month, but it just kind of turned into extinction-level event scenario movies, and we never got around to it, so I thought, oh, let's do it this month, and we'll do the aftermath. So we're going to be coming at you with post-apocalyptic movies, starting with, or TV series, as the case may be. And I suppose you could say Jericho was kind of like a bridge between those, but today we are definitely jumping on into the apocalypse with Book of Eli. And some of the basic facts of that. Does anybody got those out or shall I proceed?
Give me a second and I'll find them. But I was going to say, you know, you could also call this one Denzel Washington portrays the Vault Dweller in Fallout on the big screen. That's a horrible title and way too long.
That is a terrible title.
Basically, I'm just watching this the whole time going, it's Fallout the movie starring Denzel Washington and Mila Kunis.
Nah, because if it were Fallout, there'd be weird weapons and there'd be way too much nostalgia that didn't make sense, and there'd be in the background a guy going some other 30s jazz to make us all go, you have fun.
Also, don't forget you'd also have rad roaches in the first 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, yeah. Nothing but rad roaches.
I'd also have 1,000 glitches and microtransactions and $100 boxes where I got nothing. And
Fallout 3 and 4 were pretty awesome games, but 76, I didn't even play it. I just read all the negativity about it. Okay, Book of Eli. Yeah. Book of Eli was released on January 15th, 2010. It runs 117 minutes. It had a box office take of $157.1 million on an $80 million budget. Womp, womp, womp. Ooh. Directed by the Hughes brothers, written by Gary Whitta, starring Denzel Washington, Gary Oldman, Mila Kunis, Ray Stevenson, Jennifer Beals, Francis de la Torre, and Michael Gambon. Cinematography by Don Burgess and music by Atticus and Leopold Ross and Claudia Same.
Hey, you know, I gotta say, the music is really quite good in this. You get this notion of kind of just desolation and hopelessness, especially in the first opening scene where you see what is essentially must be nuclear winter and some feral cat walking around in a burned out forest. And it zooms in on what appears to be a character, a person hiding up against a log. with a bow and arrow knocked and just standing perfectly still. And then when the cat gets in the way, he lets the arrow fly and gets the cat for food. And he shows him walking, and it just, wow. What a powerful scene of how hopeless and devastating the world it is. That opening shot with the music really settles you in. It really does what, honestly, I think Terminator Salvation was trying to do, but utterly failed at.
You could say even more powerful is how long it takes for the first words to be uttered.
Oh, now you are correct. That is very true.
It's a it's a very effective opening for a modern film that you don't see as much. And it's a big gamble that you could lose the audience with, you know, the movie going on for like 5 minutes. You could see people in the theater rioting, going, "There's something wrong with your audio. Your audio isn't working." No, idiot. They're trying to create a mood with setting.
Desolation. It's just empty, blank desolation and devastation. And really puts you in that feeling of, this is where you are. And just the scene, like you said, Thomas, you walk in and you don't hear anything until he gets into that house. And even then, the first just few words are, first he opens a closet and sees a body, takes the boots off, and then puts them on his own feet. And the only first word you hear is him going, "Nice, nice," because they fit. And he's wearing tape for socks. And you can see his skin's messed up. And then he's listening to music on a battery on an iPod. And he sees a mouse and goes, "Want some? It's cat." But it's just so few words. And it's establishing settings so well in my mind that I felt hopeless between the music and the pastel colors and the dullness. It just... And that first fight scene, too, where he sees the woman chained to caught in the, what do you call it? Shopping cart. And he just looks up and says, "You know, what's nice about not having soap anymore is you can smell people.
Smell the hijackers from a mile away."
Yeah. And those guys show up. But the way that fight alone, it pans back from the bridge, under the bridge, the overpass. You see the guy start the chainsaw and the smoke coil out, and there's that fight, and it's just one single frame. And I think one of the things, if I can get on my high horse for a minute, that I hate about modern fight sequences is that shaky cam close-up nonsense we saw in like the Dark Knight trilogy. How am I supposed to see that anybody's good at fighting if all I do get are random sound effects interspersed with quick jump shots, close-up jump shots? I don't know if you're doing a good job. It's great if you're just trying to show bewildering, you know, blinding chaos the first time, like in Saving Private Ryan. But like everything, I think Saving Private Ryan, Spielberg did this. It worked pretty darn well when he did it, especially for Omaha Beach. And then everyone said, "Ooh, that was good. Let's do that 1,000 times.
Well, you know, I think I can tell you exactly why this upfront shaky camera thing works for fight scenes. What's easier, to shake the camera around and not let people see what's going on, or to actually choreograph a believable fight?
Right. No, that's true. I mean, it's one thing, like I said, when Spielberg did it, there was an artistic merit to it. Now, you're right. It's probably just, guy sucks at fighting, so just shake the camera.
If you're doing the Battle of Omaha Beach, you probably want everyone to be disoriented and the camera to be shaky, because you want to be lost in the fog and the distraction of war. You know, as I always say, you put your viewer in the position of your character. You put the audience there, and that shaky camera with everything disoriented and you can't clearly figure out what's going on around you, that's great for Omaha Beach. In a one-on-one fight between two protagonists, no, that just sucks.
Right. And they don't do that in this movie. But seeing that opening fight and the whole travel, it just really sets the setting perfectly before you're even plunged into the story. And so I got to give them credit for that. That really immersed me. I don't know about anybody else, or you guys, but it brought me into the action, brought me into the setting rather well. So,
But I'm going to give my 1 minute plot and then we'll dive on into this movie.
Disclaimer, so, 1 minute plot may actually be 7 minutes and 47 seconds.
I'm working on it, folks. I'm working on it, sickies. In fact, I'm going to set my clock right now. Here we go now. So basically what happens in the future, there's some kind of what we assume to be a nuclear holocaust. And Eli, who we don't find anything about as in background, is walking across the country, just heading west. He eventually finds his way into a town where it's run by a guy named Carnegie, who's played by Gary Oldman. And Carnegie is looking for books. He's sending out his minions to go find any books and read them. He's only reading the ones that are good, like Plato or Aristotle, and burning the rest, like the Oprah Winfrey book. He's really actually looking for one book in particular, which he finds out Denzel's character, Eli, has, and it's the Bible. Essentially, Carnegie wants to use the Bible as a way to manipulate the people and control them. He's already in control of the town and all the resources. He just needs the right words to make them totally loyal. And he needs the Bible for that. Unfortunately, he can't get it and gets wounded while trying to take it from Denzel. And Denzel meets in the process a woman named Solara, played by Mila Kunis. And she goes with him. She decides to go with Eli. And together they make their way going west, which is California. And eventually Eli does give him the book after running into a small group of people who, an old elderly couple that eat humans. And to get away from there, he throws the book and gives it to Carnegie, then makes his way because he's memorized the whole Bible and he doesn't need it anymore. But then after he gets to East West Coast, he finds Alcatraz. Alcatraz is where they're printing books, so he rattles off the whole Bible and they print it. Meanwhile, Carnegie finds out that the book he has is actually in Braille because it turns out Eli's blind. And Carnegie's girlfriend, what was it, Claudia? I think Claudia, she's blind, but she doesn't remember how to use Braille.
Of course.
And then it ends with that. So I think that's okay. That was just under 2 minutes. So
getting not there. Bad. Getting there.
Yeah.
So let's, with that in mind, now that we got the preliminary basic facts and plot out of the way and basically how much I love the gets you into the setting, let's start with rips and picks. And I've already listed my pick. It dives you and immerses you into the setting really well. Who's next? Who's got something? Let's start with our picks. What do you love about this?
I love the symbolism. There is a lot of symbolism and there are a lot of they're showing you that he's blind throughout the entire movie if you can pick it up. And on a rewatch, it becomes obvious that Eli is blind. But I also like some of the deeper symbolism that's in here. Just take Mila Kunis' character's name of Solara, which is light, sun, brightness. She brings a light into the darkness of Eli's world. And at the end, he says, you know, thank you for the friend I made. Watch over her like you did me. You know, she really was something that lit up his path. So there's a lot of deep symbolism to this. You can probably watch this movie many times over to try to find even more and more symbolism that that's hidden throughout this film. Like little examples that he's blind. He bumps into the step on the way up when he's going into the cannibal's house. And, you know, you're not thinking about it because you're not thinking the first time that he's blind. But as you rewatch it, you can see that.
Right. Well, and you don't find out the reveal until the very end of the movie. And so that's when it starts clicking, like, oh, that makes sense now. So they masked it pretty well because they immersed you into the setting and the story so well that why would you think to look for that?
Yep.
You know, he has his sunglasses on the whole time, but then again, so does everyone else.
Right.
Because when you go outside, you need something to cover your eyes because it's so bright, presumably from whatever fallout or devastation from nuclear war is.
Yeah. And like another example, Solara says, you know, he tells her, you can't even read. And she says, yes, so teach me. Well, that's going to be problematic.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's another hint.
Yeah. There's a lot of hints that are dropped, but there's also a lot of other subtle things that they do. I mean, other than basically your main character here, you gather that even without him saying what his motivations are, you know he's a good person.
Right.
And how he acts and reacts. He doesn't do anything. I mean, even when he's fighting the bandits and the hijackers, he doesn't go after them. He only... Right. And he basically says, you don't want to do this. Just let me go. I won't fight you. I mean, he doesn't even go after the biker gang.
Right.
Really? I mean, he says, this isn't my problem. Move on. This isn't my mission. You see that he's very much dedicated to a mission. He's not diverting from it. And you know he's not... I mean, when he's in the town, he's like offered Mila Kunis's character. He's like, no.
Yeah.
You very much see that he's not in it for himself.
Yeah, he decides to play chess with her.
Yeah. Interesting choice, but again.
Yeah.
I love the fact in this film that they show you the dichotomy of religion. Humanity's use of religion. On one hand, you have Denzel, you have Eli, who is very pure in his mission with religion, and he thinks the Bible needs to be saved and kept for society because, you know, he tells her when Solara says, what does it mean? And he says, do unto others as you do to yourself. You know, he said, that's pretty much what I've gotten from. And he summarizes the entire Bible into that. And, you know, it's a pretty good summary. And he wants to protect it. And he's going to follow on blind faith. He's going to follow the Spirit, because it's clearly the Holy Spirit guiding him, moving him. He's going to follow the Spirit where it leads, and he's not going to ask. He is a tool of God. And it is a pure faith-driven mission by a man whose character is not perfect, but tries to represent Christianity as best as he can in a post-apocalyptic world where people will kill you for your boots. And then on the other hand, you have Carnegie, who just sees the ability of religion to be a controlling force for society and to enhance his own power.
Yeah. There's a little bit more behind that from the creator, and there's something I'll share later about that involving religion when we get to themes and issues. So, but yeah, no, that's a really great part. I also really enjoy and you don't know it the first time, but when Eli goes into the bar, I believe it is, to get water, and the first thing they ask to see is his hands. And you don't know why. So he holds up his hands, and then they kind of check him out and go, oh, okay, fine. And then later on, Solara go into that house, and they're listening to disco and having tea. And then they ask her for food, and she brings out some meat. But then you see her hand twitching, and he takes Solara aside, and he's like, we got to go. They've been eating too much human meat. And so it's this idea, and they don't explain it, and really they don't have to for the purpose of the story. But apparently in this post-irradiated world, eating human eventually gives you the shakes. There's some nerve damage. Well,
that's a real disease.
Yeah. Cannibalisms actually get this.
And it's
quite common that if you eat human, you will get nerve damage.
It's called, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right, but it's called Kuru, K-U-R-U disease, a form of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease caused by eating human brains or spinal columns. Now, it's really screwed up that we know enough about real-world cannibals to know that if you eat human brains or spinal columns, you will get this disease. But yes, it's a real disease.
Now, the interesting thing being, if you don't eat the brain or the spinal fluid, you don't get it.
So that means these people were eating everything, which in a post-apocalyptic world, that makes sense. You have to make do with every part of the animal or person in this case, which gives that even more perk up because it's something, again, I wouldn't have thought of because I'm not a cannibal and I've never run into one.
Score one for every zombie movie that has the zombies lurching and unable to move in normal manners.
Right. So that I thought was a really neat touch. And the fact that when Carnegie's men show up to the house, the husband and wife are ready to fight back. Their house is decked out. They have a panic room. They have guns. They have metal plates. They have everything.
Not an RPG shield, though.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, the fact is they're decked out.
How about this apocalypse? This I like is that they actually put in the world. This isn't right after. This has been years after this event.
Right.
Guns don't work much anymore. Ammo's scarce.
Yeah.
Like when someone sees a gun that's like, yeah, that's not loaded. Because, yeah, ammunition's going to get used up quick.
Yeah, industry's gone.
Yeah. You're not going to get more bullets.
Right.
Right. And this isn't the day of a musket where you can just melt down some pewter and, use it to press it into a musket ball.
Yeah, good luck knowing how to get your saltpeter and gunpowder. Not simple, old-fashioned black powder.
Even if that worked, can you actually form it into an actual bullet casing as easily as you could, back in the 1700s when it was just a musket ball?
Nope.
Well, you know what, then? That speaks to the fact of how they describe how society has kind of reverted back to something a little more feudal. Where you have each town has a specialist. You have the engineer, who's the mechanic fix-it guy. You have your thugs, who serve the lord, if you will. Everyone has a specialty. And literacy is really reserved for a select few. And that makes sense. And I don't want to get too far into it yet about society, because we'll talk about that more, I'm sure. But plus, I don't want to go into it much. It's the same old tired thing we've talked about before. But
I will say, as my first rip, I think they should have made this happen more than 30 years after The Flash, because it is amazing how many people are illiterate within 30 years of that event. I can see a 50% literacy rate, but it looks like we've got about a 8% literacy rate going on in this society, and it's been 30 years since the apocalypse, and I don't think one of the symptoms of fallout is that you forget how to read.
Well, not just that, but with it being only 30 years, it depending on what this was, if it was a nuclear blast, which seems very likely, nuclear war,
yeah.
What on earth are we talking about here? Because this had to be a major event to do this much damage.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And only 30 years later, everyone seems fine, and you're talking like, oh, water supplies, we can get water here, and think, no, 30 years later, you're still having problems.
But yeah, unless this was an attack that wasn't on the scale that it had to be to have no remnant of the United States government or a Canadian government or a South, one of these South American countries, being, or all of them in a coalition having a functioning government. I mean, there should be something left of society 30 years later. It shouldn't have fallen apart that quick unless you had the type of war that would leave the earth so contaminated that you wouldn't really be able to be up and moving around above ground for long without being irradiated and dead.
Maybe a bunch of Tsar Bombas got dropped.
Well, that's the thing. You go over there when he finally makes it. You see what is left of civilization, basically. They're reconstructing. And they are reconstructing from nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a Quran. This is the first Bible they're getting. They're getting a few books. They're excited about getting the almost all the encyclopedias.
Right.
I'm like, seriously, they went from nothing. That means if this is the reconstruction, that had to be a total wipeout.
They're just about to get the printing press working again.
Right. And we're talking Gutenberg style. So we're talking, we are really stepping back, which means no one should be surviving. We shouldn't really even see towns.
Right.
We shouldn't see raiders.
Well,
by the way, 30 years, how are they driving vehicles around? Because stabilizing gas for 30 years, good luck.
Yeah, unless, again, they found a stash under that town, but that would have been one giant stash or just recently discovered.
Well, gas, you can't – that's what I'm saying. If you store gas any long period of time, you have to actually add chemicals to it to stabilize.
Yeah, it varnishes.
Right. Otherwise, gasoline separates out and it no longer works as gasoline.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. 30 years, we should not be seeing anything close to what we are seeing for this type of destruction, which, again, had to be total, all-out war.
Tsar bombas.
Well, now just everyone unleashing every single nuclear weapon right. in their arsenal. And correct. Some that they were in development, apparently, because it's like, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
I mean, at one scene, you see him walking by a crater that looks like it probably was a blast.
Yeah, that's right.
At the same time, there's not enough left and there's too much left. And I think what really should have been done was this should have been something a couple hundred years down the road. And more along the lines of the Flash and the war didn't take out all the world governments, but in the chaos that followed, organized society fell and degenerated. And you need more than 30 years for that to happen.
So that's a really good rip.
I see why they couldn't is because they the story they were trying to tell.
Yeah, you got to have people who remember the old days.
Right.
So otherwise, it's like, how did that guy remember that?
Right, it doesn't fit for the story, but yeah, that's a rip, just because it doesn't seem to work.
Yeah, but you know what? Interesting, I always say when you make a good story, some of these inconsistencies are easy. Well, first of all, you're allowed a certain number, and I don't know what that magic number is.
Three.
But when it's a good, okay.
I don't know. I just thought when band
three, I thought it.
We thought we nailed it.
I kept being told that 2 + 2 = 5, but okay.
Well, no. Now,
the states changed it to 3, okay.
So, the, yeah. So, the, what was I getting at? Oh, yeah. When the story's good, there's inconsistencies. A certain number you allow, but when the story sucks, each one is just harder and harder. So
yeah, when the story is good, I think you're going to have any number of inconsistencies and no one cares.
Well, I don't know any, but you're more forgiving.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to jump on another pick. I liked the action scenes in this. The fight scenes were really well done. They were edgy your seat and they broke up the tension pretty well. It never seemed dragging because of it. I thought it was well paced.
For a talky film about the role of religion in human society, this film never truly drags and has pacing issues.
Yeah, so.
I got another rip, and it's my only other rip, really, and it's the big rip. Eli's feats that he could accomplish and his ability to sense, observe, and interact with the world seem exceptional for a man who has sight, and almost impossible for a man who has sight. But I was willing to, you know, suspend disbelief and give him the John McClane benefit of the doubt that he could do all these things. And when you find out that he's been doing all these things blind, so that's a big problem on the rewatch in certain ways, too, because absolutely none of it seems believable. I mean, the movie goes back on the old trope that if you're blind, your other senses increase, and that's not proven to be true, that someone who's blind has any more of an acute sense of smell or hearing or touch.
It's true to a degree, more because you rely on it, not because they're so much better.
Right. You learn maybe to use that sense more because you have to, but it doesn't become sharper. Like, your hearing isn't going to magically get better because you rip your eyes out of your head.
Yeah.
Admittedly, you can train. I mean, if you did a lot, and I'm talking a lot of training, some of it would be possible. I wouldn't say all.
Well, I guess now I'm seeing new studies. I should have checked this first, because now there's some new studies out there that the brain might rewire itself to actually enhance some of those other connections. So I guess this is one of those things that I should have checked the current view of science on.
This is neuroplasticity we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, neuroplasticity of the brain and how its adaptability and adapts from damage and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a new small study in 2017, I guess, and maybe that's been refuted since then. But okay, I'll stand corrected on that and take that one rip out. But it still seems too much. It still seems almost like I am one with the Force is one with me in Rogue One, where, you know, he was doing things that if Master Yoda did it, I wouldn't have believed it.
Right. Well, do we got any more? Because that's a pretty good transition you did there, Scott.
I really don't have any other real.
Yeah.
I'll do a pick just real quick. Just, this made me have a new appreciation for the acting skills of Denzel Washington. You know, he hasn't been as active in film recently, so I haven't seen as many of his, you know, films recently. But, you know, watching this, you're just reminded of his command of scenes and his command of his craft. He really is one of the probably the best American actors that we have. I mean, he's at the top of the list, and he can play whatever role you want to give him. And I'm pretty interested in seeing what he does as Lord Macbeth in The Tragedy of Macbeth sometime in 2021 or 2022. So, but yeah, his acting skills are phenomenal. And you gotta, Mila Kunis probably doesn't get enough credit for her own ability to act. And she plays that role of Solara very well, very strong. And I think it's part of, you know, Mark, you said when the story's good, you can get away with stuff. When the characters are good and the characters draw you in and you like the characters, it works too. And you've got a very effective villain played by Gary Oldman. So, I mean, you've got a tour de force. Yeah, you've got a tour de force of three very skilled performers in Denzel and Mila Kunis and Gary Oldman. And it really carries this film past some of its plot holes and flaws and places where it overreaches its grasp.
Absolutely. And stunt work and all the choreography is done excellently, so that the fight scenes flow and it's smooth and it's isn't janky, and you don't have a guy in the background just twirling his lightsaber.
Yeah. Or waiting to strike because the actor doesn't know how to fight.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a very well choreographed, well done movie on a visual aspect too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought we'd jump in then with some issues or themes that come up. And Scott, you know, you jumped into the theme, the first issue I wanted to mention. And that is, well, for the first one I put in, I'm not even going to go into it. Humanity not civilized. When civilization is destroyed, how will people act? They're all atrocious. Blah, blah, blah. Walking dead. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, we've done that to death over the 160 symptoms and probably 127 of them. So,
yeah. So let's move on then to the point. And I heard you and Thomas talking about this when I logged in. Was he blind? So what was that chat you and Thomas were talking about? Because it was pretty good.
There is a fan theory that says that Eli was blind before the Flash, and after the Flash had his sight returned to him by God, so that he could complete his task. And then once he got to Alcatraz, had his sight taken away from him. And they cite that if you watch at certain times in the movie, you can see his eyes and he's not blind. I tend to disagree with this. I don't believe that he had selective sight given to him. I believe that he was blind for the entire film and that he was guided by the Spirit. He was filled with the Spirit and he took on faith. He heard the Lord speaking to him. He heard the Spirit and he, without questioning, acted whenever he was told to and followed a path. I think that's the message that was trying to be sent here about pure faith and what someone who was pure in their faith could accomplish.
Well, not just that, but when you actually watch, again, if you watch the film for the first time and you don't know that he's blind, the reveal is a shocker.
Oh, definitely.
It will hit you. But then, if you watch it again, you know he's blind. And you will then notice little things like him stumbling up a step or him staring off at something. I mean, he pulls open the door and you got a dead guy right there. He doesn't react to the dead guy until he smells him.
Yep.
So Or when he's shuffling, looking in this car, he's not looking as much as he's feeling around, noticing things. He's knows where the gas pedals are. He's checking those, the boots.
Yeah, even in the first fight scene where he says, if you put that hand on me again, you're not going to get it back. Well, I mean, that he has to wait for the, you know, he's kind of like saying, go ahead, touch me again, because I need you to touch me so I know where you are, or move, or something.
Right. There's a lot of subtle movements and things like that where he's not showing that he can see something subtly. It's very subtle, but if you know it's there, it comes across. I mean, even a good example is the gunfight in the middle of town.
Oh, that's a great example.
If you think he's not blind, he's just staring the guy down. But if he's blind, the guy's not making sound. So he doesn't know he's there. He doesn't know, and he's just staring there. And
right.
Like, is anyone else going to show up? No? Okay, I'm moving on. And that is more powerful than knowing that he can't see is just this bit where you notice a little thing. And again, well acted, because, again, not knowing it, you wouldn't know. But once you know it, little subtle movements and gestures much more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he's unpacking the backpack to get his water, he knows where things are, but you notice he feels in there. He's not looking in there as much as he's feeling in there and then pulling out what he wants.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's a fan theory that I dismiss out of hand. The other fan theory is that this is a sequel to Fahrenheit 451, and I think it's just wishful thinking and it fits together well, but I don't believe it's truly a sequel to Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, none of the creators even suggest that, so I'm going to dismiss that right away.
That one doesn't make sense, in my opinion.
I think they just decided that because all the books are missing, and so that explains where the books went, but that's about it. So, the next one I want to go over, that's the biggie in here, the big topic is religious manipulation, which if you were listening at the intro, that was a very deliberately planned intro to fit this. And Scott, if somehow that doesn't work out, you're going to have to edit this. But the idea that I went and spliced in a bunch of, or Scott rather did, a bunch of televangelists who talk about, if they're not condemning, they're asking for money and talking about the importance of money and send me your money. And then it ends with Jesus. Well, that's what these televangelists were saying. But what did Jesus actually say? And to show that stark contrast, that the televangelists are like Carnegie and Jesus would be the Christ-like figure in this story. Particularly given the fact that if you watch the DVD, there's an animated short where the writer is giving a background of Carnegie. When he was a boy, his mother was writing checks to some televangelist all the time. So he eventually got sick of it because here he was living in some kind of poverty. And part of it was because she was writing all these checks thinking that God would bless her. So he eventually just stole the checks and burnt the house down with his parents inside and left. And but that's where he got the idea of trying to get a Bible to manipulate people, because he says in there, for one, I just don't have the words. I know what to do. I just don't have the words. And later on, when just someone says, well, what are you so big about? It's what do you need? It's just a book. And he screams, it's not a book. It's a weapon. And that's why I called this. That's why we called this the weapon, the Book of Eli, the weapon for the apocalypse, because this is really how he is going to take control of these people.
And, you know, it's pretty telling, too, that they burned all the Bibles and they burned all the religious books after the war because they blamed Christianity and the Bible for causing the war. And that makes me think that it was a religious conflict. Right. And it might have been, you know, the most common one would probably be something that happened in a conflict between Christianity and Islam, because that seems to be where the big religious conflict is, with two religions that really, you know, it's not like Hinduism that has ends for other religions or Buddhism that can accept other religions. You've got, you know, two of the big three. You got three religions in this world that all in theory worship the same God, but that God has a different prophet who's told the world how to worship him. And all three of those religions pretty much say only our view is correct and there's no other, you know, there's no middle ground.
Scott, I'm going to throw a fact out there. Hindus do not accept everybody. There's a bunch of Muslims in India that would love to counter you right now about that.
Okay. Let me say that Hinduism doesn't accept everything, but it has slightly more wiggle room for alternate views, I believe.
I'll grant you that. They just don't always do it.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you know, the Hindus are going to incorporate Jesus into their pantheon of gods. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but, you know, Hinduism it seems to be one of the less extreme, my way or the highway religions.
Maybe I'm wrong. Again, go to India and find out.
Well, wait. For one, we're going down a side road, and that's also nationalism combined with religiosity.
Touche.
We're accelerating down the side path. I love it.
Hey, you start going down side paths, we start running down them at full speed. But no,
that's us.
I guess it fits with religious manipulation, because the fact is that has led to a number of religious warfare in India. So
yes, but my point is, it doesn't, you don't even, religious warfare does not require it to even be a different religion.
Correct.
You can have religious warfare within the same religion.
Catholics and Protestants.
Sunni Shiite have Catholics and Protestants.
Correct.
So it doesn't require it to be a different religion for you to have religious conflict and religious schisms.
That's true.
Religion is a powerful organizer, extremely powerful.
Yeah.
And it will allow for great things and moving. Let's be perfectly honest. Christianity was extremely good in the Middle Ages for what it did.
Something had to step into the power vacuum of the Roman Empire, and that was the Catholic Church.
Right, and it organized people into a system that allowed for some limited progress and continued existence in an organized way that advanced slowly at times. It was needed.
It's brilliant. And you know, the Catholic Church isn't the first to do it, and Islam isn't the first to do it. I mean, there's a reason that the Egyptians said that they were part God and descended from God. You want to, you know, one of the ways to control people and to get a population to do what you're telling them to do and not question is to say that your commands are divinely inspired and coming from the God of the universe. And, it, you know,
Mandate
I mean, it's...
Heaven.
How do you argue with that?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, literally, you had the mandate of heaven
coming
from China.
Yeah.
Like you all have always, again, being American and being this time period, we don't think of things as how it used to be, where you had the idea of individualism and being a person is so different than what it used to be. And this thing organized people in a way that worked. And it has its downsides also, being that, yes, when you organize people, you always have to have the out and the non-you. And unfortunately, that comes with the territory of religion also.
The Bible is not a book of science. It's not a book of a political system or an economic system. So
no, it amazes me that anybody would think it is. I mean, Jesus is pretty clear about that with give unto God what is God and unto Caesar what is Caesar's. I mean, you know, I mean, and there's more of that where he's very, very clear that it is that you're not getting any prosperity on this earth from following him. If it happens, it does, but
some people are weird. I've heard one person try to explain that in Proverbs, when Solomon says it is better to use the right hand than the left hand, he was implying modern political terminology. And I thought, so you're telling me that a Hebrew king from before Christ was making a reference to a political ideology that did not come into play until the French Revolution. And this was a guy, by the way, who was a king.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And instead of referring it in context as it was, meaning in that culture, you ate with your right hand and wiped with your left hand. That's why you don't eat with the left hand. Instead of taking it in that context, you took it in that direction, which is like, you're telling me that a monarch from ancient times was talking about democratic principles today.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what people, you know, the human brain has an ability to see patterns or truths in things where none exist.
And let's be honest, when we are speaking about the Bible is very clearly set up as principles to live by. It's not set up as an economic system, political system. There are religions and books written as political systems, but not the Bible.
No.
And you know, I feel, you know, Mark, sometimes you say this and you know, I agree. I feel, you know, I'll put my faith away here in a second and not make this dominant about that, but the Bible itself is not what's flawed. It's man who is flawed, who goes to, you know, his own imperfections cause him or her to interpret the word incorrectly.
Correct. And that's what's happening here.
Yes, because absolutely. Because, yes, I mean, let's be honest. Most books, religions have kernels of good in them. Truth of something there.
I would say all religions are an attempt to lay down a framework of rules and morals and values to create a peaceful and ordered society. Your determination of peaceful and benevolent might be different, but I think most of the goals of any religion is to create a peaceful and ordered society.
I would say, I don't know if I can say all because I haven't studied all.
Can't say all, but I think many of them are.
Yes, and I would absolutely agree with you, though.
I would try to explain them, too, yeah.
They exist to put order, to get order out of chaos. And let's be honest, the world is chaos. And everything, and we try, as humanity, to organize ourselves. And I mean, in this movie, it's very clear that they are trying to, I mean, yes, he's a bad guy, but he's trying to make order here. So he's going to use the ultimate book to bring order. I mean, religion has brought order out of chaos for centuries. He wants that.
Yeah.
And he's going to try it. And I mean, and even then, at the end of this film, he brings the Bible to these guys and they start printing it. So even then, that's going to start spreading it, because they were like, we're going to start spreading the, you know, all the knowledge we have back out there and teaching people. So the Bible is going to go back out there and bring, and the rest of the religious texts are going to go back out there and bring order from chaos. They're going to go back out and do exactly what they have always done.
Yep. I think it's
interesting.
It's a shared deep meaning, is that, you know, this film, because we all three got to it, it's this film, and it's not, you know, anything that you got to really do some digging to get to. It's pretty much on the surface. But this film is showing you how humanity over the years have used religion, period. Whether you're going to use it for your own earthly power and means and misuse it, or some would say use it correctly, because that's its true use, or whether you're going to do what Eli wants to do with it, which is to use it to free everybody and to create a better society without it being a trapping of power. And I think that the people in Alcatraz are going to use it that way too. They're probably using it much more secular as just preserving a culture. But yeah, Thomas, you're right. It's going to spread again. And some people use it like Carnegie.
And, you know, it reminds me, too, also of the concept of Reformation, because Carnegie wants to be the only person who can read it for obvious reasons, so he can control the narrative. And when you look at the medieval church, it was their view that the laity didn't need to read the Bible.
That's why they would never print it into the vernacular. It was always in Latin.
Exactly. And so, but you had movements even before Luther, like the Waldensians. The Waldensians were considered heretics, but when you look at what they believed, it was nothing that we would consider shocking at all. Like, read the Bible in your own language, and you can read it on your own. That was considered heresy. Now, of course, it's considered like, why aren't you doing that? If you're a Christian, you should be doing that on your own.
Right. Yes, but there is some discussion to have, and I say some, being that at the time, your Bibles had to be handwritten.
Well, that's true, but I'm saying there was also the ideology that the laity doesn't need to read, because putting the Bible into vernacular was forbidden. It had to be Latin. And
I know. I'm saying there is some discussion to have, because remember, it's much easier to transcribe straight to straight. You go Latin to Latin. You don't go from Latin to German. And again, we're also talking about languages that really didn't actually have a really written language. Or even people who read. I mean, we're talking about farmers who all they know is farming and surviving. They don't know how to read and write, really.
Yeah, but that's, we're talking like German and Czech, two languages that had a written form, and English for that matter, and also people being forbidden to even learn how to do it.
And I'm
the difference between, it's one thing with practicality and, well, they couldn't read it anyway. There's another thing when you're outright forbidden.
And I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying, yes, it should not have been forbidden. I'm saying it also was probably unlikely to have succeeded at the time.
Yeah, it couldn't have succeeded until after Gutenberg, really, to have
the
mass laity reading the Bible in the vernacular. Sure,
but the fact that there was a movement to prevent it is my point. And that's where you would have someone like Carnegie come along, and he wants to control the narrative, and Eli and Alcatraz Press and then later Solaris want to go out there and prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Any leader wants to control the sources of information, control public opinion.
Sure.
And anyone who's truly doing a populist movement and a decentralized government movement would want that narrative not to be controlled by anybody and to have an open narrative. And it's been something to the dawn of time. How do you control the narrative, and how do you control the opinion of the masses or the mob, if you will?
Right. And I mean, you also have, again, literacy in the modern day is almost ubiquitous. I mean,
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to find someone who cannot read on at least a basic level. I mean, sure, you put down a, you know, a textbook about, you know, biology, you know, or quantum physics. There's words in there that not everyone knows.
You have to go to a developing country or, well, I mean, there's a lot of illiterate people in the country that slide through the education system, but not as much as like a developing country.
Right. And that's why I said basic. I used keywords, so basic literary skills.
But Thomas is right about functional literacy because, you know, we are all literate, but our ability to truly understand graduate level text on quantum physics is very limited. We're going to sit there and read a quantum physics book, and if it's written for the specialist, we're going to understand maybe 20% of it. We're going to read it, we're going to know the words, but are we going to understand it?
Right. And this is where we have to be very careful with how we condemn things like that, because I agree with you absolutely that we want knowledge in as many hands as possible. But that also means we have to know when we don't know something. Right now, we're in the middle of COVID and wear masks. And you have people saying it, you know, without factual knowledge, saying it doesn't do anything.
Well, because, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, too.
I'm saying knowledge has to be out there, but you also have to have knowledge coming from reputable sources and actual people who know what they're talking about. Because if you have people who don't know, if you give someone a quantum, you know, quantum physics textbook who doesn't understand quantum physics and then ask them questions about it, you're probably not going to get the right answer.
Well, you know, just going back to the Bible part, though, it also is anathema to try to restrict the scripture when your whole goal is to spread it. You know, basically that's what Jesus said to do. So, but yes, other things though, that's a little, you're making a point. So
welcome to Comparative World Religions Malady on Raving Lunatic Media.
We've failed because we haven't really compared other religions.
No, sorry. My point was just going to be, and I'm going to get to it and then we should move on. But my point was going to be, you're right, but we have to, the idea, and this was kind of brought up in this, where he wanted to be the only one reading it. So the idea being that if you have so many people who don't know how to read, who are illiterate, you can easily have, yes, an actual Bible given to tons of people in their own language. But unless everyone can read it and everyone has access to it, you might have one person who can read telling 50 people something that's not true. It's
right.
I'd argue today that in that way in religion, I'd still say 85% of the parishioners, whatever religion it is, are probably taking whatever interpretation the priest or pastor or reverend, whatever the equivalent of is of that in any religion is, and not really thinking for themselves on it. I mean,
well,
I'd like to think most people are trying to come to their own interpretation of their religion, but I think mostly, you know, people show up to church and wait for the pastor to tell them how they should interpret the word of God.
You know, I've heard enough pastors bemoan the fact that people aren't studying on their own, so I think you're probably right.
Yeah, and this film brings up these questions. I mean, this film does not do this subtly, which somehow, let's just be honest, most of the times when I get hit over the head with a message from a film, I hate it. I'm just going to say point blank. If a film is hitting me in the face with a message, I normally hate the film. I hate the
I definitely get that.
Somehow this film does not do that. It did it in a way that it is in my face. It's hitting me in the face with it. But I don't seem to care.
Because, you know, it's not exactly... It's not screaming with the neon sign telling you Carnegie's bad, Carnegie's bad, Carnegie's bad. It's letting you see it through his actions. You're right, reaching that conclusion on your own. And I think that's why.
I also think that the film doesn't, for me personally, I don't mind if you're hitting me in the face with the issue you want to discuss, but where it becomes, I lose interest is when the film is simply hitting me in the face with the only way I can feel about the issue being discussed. And this film almost gives you three ways to use the Bible. One is as a method of centralizing power and keeping that power. One is a way to better all of human society. And the third is what the, for lack of a better term, monks on Alcatraz want to do and keep it as a store of human culture and history. So, I mean, it shows you, you know, two different secular ways to use the Bible and one good religious way to use the Bible. And then it leaves it open to you to decide which is the proper use of religion.
Yeah, there it is.
I think you're right. It brings up the concept that it wants to discuss, but it doesn't sit there and just tell you what you should think about it. It brings it to mind. There you go. Well said, Scott.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'm with you, Thomas. When they are giving you that, here's the message, here's how you think, here's how this message, here's how you should think, I'm already turned off. You know, I'm done. You know, when you tell me I'm supposed to like this character because they fit a box and fit a slot, fit a demographic pool, I'm done. I'm not interested anymore because that's not a character anymore. That's now a puppet that fits, that checks off your box.
Yep. You're correct.
But I think somehow I've already given away my rating.
Yeah. So, Are we about ready to rate this thing and get out of here?
I was just about to say, with that in mind, let's go ahead then, Thomas. I mean, Thomas, you started first. Let's do how many feral cats.
Ooh, feral cats, okay.
Because that's what he kills at the beginning, so.
Yeah, fair enough.
How many feral cats do you give this, Thomas?
Okay. I think I'm going to give it a 7.5. Maybe 7.8, let's say.
Is it the head or the tail of the cat that makes up the three quarter of a cat?
It's the cat oil that he uses for lip.
Okay.
But no, it's a good film. And I love this film. It's just not one of those films that I'm going to be flipping through channels and be like, ooh, Book of Eli's on. I got to watch that. It's not one of those. It is excellently done, is well done, fantastic. But I don't know if it's a film I go back and watch over and over again. There is, once you get what you're going to get out of it, it's not going to give you too much more. I think it's probably good for two, maybe three viewings before it doesn't really add much. I'm going to bump it up to 8. I talked myself into an 8.
Okay.
Okay.
Keeping in mind that in the Scott Kennison rating scale and weighting, a 5 is a thoroughly average film, I'm going to give The Book of Eli 6 feral cats. The acting of the cast and the smart direction given to them pulls this film up. The use of cinematography, camera, angles, and sound to effectively create setting pulls this film up. It's a simple plot, but at times, most of the time, I believe that the film is grasping for something that it can't reach. It's trying to make a really deep statement about religion, and I don't think it gets there. It's trying to make a deep statement about the nature of humanity, and I don't think it gets there. And I think that the ending becomes somewhat of a letdown. I mean, at its core, this film is a story about a blind man trying to carry the Bible to Alcatraz Island so that monks can make a copy of it and reprint it. And I think that's where you've gotten as much out of this film as you can get out of it. And that's because of the truly great professionals that are, you know, telling us this story on screen by their acting ability. But I think it misses some of what it's going for, and it falls short of being a really having that deep discussion that it wants to. And I think the plot is just a little, it's a thin plot. It's a very thin plot that relies a lot on, it's an escape film. You're trying to outrun the posse for the majority of the film. It definitely has, you know, Western roots, and it would be, you know, I saw it called neo-Western sci-fi noir, not noir, neo-Western sci-fi, and I agree with it. But it's a good film. It's an okay film. It's better than average, but I don't think I can put it up there in the realms of an 8, a 9, or a 10, which I, you know, got to be for some of the films that I like a lot. So I think that's where this one is. It's somewhat forgettable, shallow plot, amazingly well acted, a decent, somewhat discussion of human society and religion and the role that it plays, but it fails to really do all that it's trying to do.
Okay, I'll give it I can't decide, 7 or 8, because it touches on those religious themes which are near and dear to my heart, because I detest televangelists who dilute the Bible and ruin the message, or any religious extremist for that matter. And it shows what they are. They're manipulators. They're, you know, the Apostle Paul would call them deviants who have an impure mind. And that's what Gary Oldman is. He has that. There, Carnegie has that goal. I love how they immerse you in the setting. It really does feel like a post-apocalyptic world that was devastated by the most horrendous nuclear weapons you could think, and in quantity. And I also, one more, you know, pick that just suddenly thought of that makes me think of it, when they're bartering, when he's using little wet naps to bathe himself, and he goes in and they say, you know, the engineer, Tom Waits, says, "Do you have chapstick?" He's like, "No, I got cat oil." "Oh, wait." And he pulls out the wet naps, and that's just to get his battery charged. So that kind of given play of showing society, it really, because it immerses me in that setting and has that religious-based theme, I am willing to give it that high score. It loses the point for the blind thing, which is fantastic, but a little eh. So, well, that's a pretty good rating. I'd say we enjoyed that film overall. So, however, next week, let's see if I can remember what was on our plate next week, gentlemen. I sent a list and now I forgot it.
Stand by and I'll find it.
Yeah, you got to reforward that to me.
You know, Ragemaster, you are the, you know, if this was a mega corporation, everyone would have a title. So you are the vice president in charge of content and production. And yeah, so you got to remember this stuff.
I remember most of it. I just don't remember the order.
10 last on Earth.
What's that?
10 last on Earth.
Last on Earth.
That's what you
wait, that's right. It's the Netflix show. That's the next. I think it was actually Io. Io.
Ah.
I changed it.
Okay, Io, last on Earth.
Yeah, that's a Netflix movie, Io. And then after that, well, I'm going to hold off. After that, I know what it is. I remember everything after that. I'm going to hold off because that's a special treat that I know Scott is thrilled to bits about.
Yeah, and
I think many Sickies will be happy about it
too. Yeah, I am surprised, Thomas, you're able to find that quickly. I had to scroll through hundreds upon hundreds of texts of our epic argument about the current political situation. On the next episode of Political Malady on RavingLunaticMedia.com.
That'll be by them. So, Scott, thank you, Sickies. If you wanted to comment on what we think of Book of Eli, you agree with us, you don't agree with us. If you want to also get information about our upcoming project we're going to be recording with Ethan over at Den of Age of Geek pretty soon, you can contact us at
RavingLunaticMedia.com. RavingLunaticMedia.com. That's RavingLunaticMedia.com. And shameless self-production, for the first time in well over a year, I put up new content under Quick Rants. And maybe, possibly, I put up another one here shortly. Wear your mask, people. There's a hint.
And be on the lookout for our collaboration with Age of Geek pretty soon with Ethan.
Absolutely. So what is left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay sick, sickies.